From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made on August 25th in Stockholm, Sweden, where a private VIP audience of 29 people had been impatiently waiting at the Royal Institute of Technology, waiting for the featured speaker, Stephen Hawking. Now, Hawking is one of the most famous scientists in the world, and his appearances always draw crowds, but this time was different. This time, Stephen Hawking had promised to unveil his solution to a 40-year-old mystery in physics. He claimed to have solved black holes, well, at least in a manner of speaking. More specifically, Hawking was about to explain his solution for how information escapes from black holes. Others had declared this conundrum unsolvable, but not Hawking, and so the audience was perhaps a bit disappointed that Hawking's black hole presentation was about 9 minutes long. Remember, this was an audience of remarkable science minds, and even they found it somewhat vague or confusing, according to PBS reporting. But they also found the possibilities exhilarating, and they wanted more details from Hawking. Don't we all? Well, this hour, we're going to peel back what we know about black holes, what we might learn from Stephen Hawking. And my guest is a man who explains complex science in digestible terms for mass audiences. One of my favorite guests, Brian Koberline, who's an astrophysicist, a senior lecturer at RIT, and the author of a science blog called One Universe at a Time. Nice to have you, Brian.
Thanks. It's great to be back.
If you were in that audience in Stockholm, would you have been disappointed?
I probably would have been confused like everyone else.
What do we expect now? I mean, he's sort of been hinting that he's got something really big figured out. But he hasn't given us a full, actual, workable science paper on this, right?
Right. He's given a presentation or a lecture on this, a very short lecture. And he and his colleagues plan on releasing a paper at the end of September, the beginning of October.
Okay. And so throughout this hour, we're going to sort of work through what it is that we do know and what we don't know and what the big questions are. But if you want to call with any science fun questions, black holes, or really deep space, that's... We always talk about fun stuff with Brian Koberline. You can call the program 844-295-TALK, toll-free 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Step one, let's identify what Stephen Hawking is claiming to be working on and about to release. So what exactly is it about black holes that he thinks he's got figured out?
Well, what he thinks is he thinks he's solved something known as the information paradox. Basically, when something were to go into a black hole, and the idea of a black hole is that if something goes into it, it's forever trapped. If something goes into a black hole, can we tell anything about it? Do we know any information about when it went into that black hole? And Einstein, had basically, his theory had said no. And Hawking says yes. So he thinks he solved this idea.
I love the fact that we've got Einstein and Hawking disagreeing. I wish Einstein could kind of sit down with them and fight it out. But when you say information, can we kind of back up? Because in my very rudimentary idea of black holes is that they like to gobble up things around them. Things go into them.
Right.
Don't come out. So when you say information, you're talking about really anything that goes into a black hole?
Yeah, when we look in physics, we think about physics as being about physical objects interacting and that type of thing. But actually, what we found over time is that what's really important is what we can know about physical objects. It's the information that those objects contain that we can actually tell that becomes almost more important than the physical stuff themselves.
Okay, so something goes into a black hole, and then all of a sudden we can get no more information from it. Is that right?
Right. If it goes into a black hole and it doesn't come out, we don't know anything about it. We can't get any information from it. Because a black hole is defined only by three basic properties: what its mass is, if it has any charge, electric charge, and if it's rotating. And those are the only three things that we know about a black hole itself.
Why do those things matter?
Well, because those determine everything about the black hole. No matter what you put into a black hole, what is left over is mass, rotation, and charge.
Okay. Now, I want to sort of ask the lay questions, and you know, feel free to laugh, but let's walk through this because I was joking with Brian before the hour began. I did see Interstellar. I did not know there were tesseracts in the middle of black holes. Probably not, huh?
No
tesseracts in the middle of black holes. But do we know of the location of any black hole actually close? What's the closest black hole that we know of to us?
Well, I know the closest big black hole is in the center of our galaxy.
In the center of our own galaxy.
Right. There are different types of black holes. There are black holes that are about the mass of a star. They're called stellar mass black holes. And then there are supermassive black holes. These can be the mass of millions or billions of stars, and they're typically in the centers of galaxies. So we know that there's a supermassive black hole in the center of our galaxy.
Supermassive.
About 4 million solar masses.
So just for a moment, let it sink in how big of a universe we live in.
Okay.
Brian's already knows this. I'm talking to myself and maybe to listeners. That is it's not unbelievable. It's believable, but it's just amazing. The black hole in the center of our galaxy is, again, how big do we think?
About 4 million times the mass of our sun.
Wow. And then by definition, it's getting bigger all the time?
When it's taking in matter, yeah.
Is it always doing that?
Well, black holes can go through active periods and dormant periods. So
they take naps?
Well, they stop eating.
They stop eating. Seriously, they do.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, they can be quiet where there's not a lot of material going into them. And then there are other ones where you can have a lot of material going into them.
Do we know why they would get more quiet?
Well, generally, if you have stuff falling into a black hole, the material as it's trying to squeeze into this black hole gets superheated. It creates a lot of light and pressure, and that will tend to push material back. So basically, you have gravity trying to pull things in. Things get superheated. You get things like jets and accretion disks, and then it pushes back a bit. And so when it does that, the material kind of goes away a bit, and you can enter a quiet period.
Okay, we already have a question. Mike wants to know, do black holes swallow entire planets?
They can. They can swallow entire stars.
Have we observed this happening?
We've seen some indications of material going into a black hole, where we see this burst of X-rays, for example, as material goes into a black hole. It's hard to observe them directly because they're so small compared to the distances. So if you look at the black hole in the center of our galaxy, it's about 30,000 light years away. Its size, its event horizon, is smaller than the radius of the Earth's orbit around the sun. So you're trying to see something that's incredibly small on a cosmic scale that's really far away.
Okay. Eventually, whatever causes the end of... What happens first? That black hole gobbles up us or the sun burns out?
The sun burns out.
That's going to happen first?
Yeah.
Okay. So we don't have to worry about the black hole that's roughly in our neighborhood?
No.
It's not really in our neighborhood.
Yeah, it's close on a cosmic scale, but we have no need to worry about it.
Okay. So you wrote something in your blog, One Universe at a Time, that... Not that I want to challenge. I have no intellectual heft to challenge Brian. But didn't you say that you don't think there is much difference between information that goes in and is trapped versus information that is destroyed? Something goes into a black hole, you consider it destroyed.
Right. We can't access it. We can never recover it again.
But if it's in there, mm-hmm. you don't know that it's destroyed in the sense that we think of destroyed, do you?
Well, in a physical sense, if we cannot gather information about an object, then the information that we could have gathered in the past and now we can't because it's inside a black hole is inaccessible to us. It is, for all intents and purposes, destroyed.
Okay, but I am never going to ride my bike to Pluto. But that doesn't mean that it's not there. Pluto is inaccessible to me as a bike rider. But it doesn't mean that it's destroyed because I can't get to it, right?
Right. And when we talk about information, we mean accessible even in principle.
Okay.
And so if it falls into a black hole and is forever trapped, it's not accessible even in principle. There's no way that we can do it.
There's nothing to observe gone.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Okay. And what is Stephen Hawking saying about this then?
Well, Stephen Hawking's most famous work is of something known as Hawking radiation. And basically what he showed in the 1970s was that black holes don't just suck everything in and take them forever. What happens is, because of quantum mechanics, there's fluctuations and fuzziness, and that can cause radiation to escape from a black hole. So black holes can actually give off energy. In Hawking's original work, that energy coming off was just completely random. It was like static. What Hawking thinks now is that anything that falls into a black hole leaves a kind of imprint on the surface of the black hole. And that imprint affects the Hawking radiation, so that in principle, from the Hawking radiation, we could get the information.
Do you find that plausible?
It's a lot of people have worked on it. I would lean more towards that than towards the idea that information is destroyed, because that would cause bigger problems than physics.
But you have to then, and this is what's about to get really fun about the process. If he releases this paper, it's about to be peer-reviewed, and probably very rigorously so, right?
Oh, very rigorously so, yeah. Yeah, people will try and rip it apart as much as they can.
Especially because it's Stephen Hawking.
Right, if you can take him down.
is there any more glee in the scientific community because you'd be peer-reviewing someone like that who's a titan?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, there's, on the one hand, people who are known as titans tend to be right an awful lot. So it can be harder to take them down. But at the same time, you really want to. I mean, we love trying to prove each other wrong.
That is, to me, the most misunderstood aspect of science. You know, and before I get to the phone, and we're going to get to the phones in just a second, Paul in Rochester, we'll start with you in just a moment. A lot of people sent me, a lot of listeners, especially listeners who really like the science programs on this show, will send me emails or links online to various ideas. And a lot of people sent me links to the recent story about the psychological studies that were not replicable. I don't know if you saw it, Brian.
Right. I think they did 100 of them.
Yeah, 98 studies, and only 35 had the results reproduced in sort of an opportunity to replicate the results. And first of all, it's really easy to misunderstand what that means. Mm-hmm. But second of all, a lot of people were saying, see, you can't trust results in studies. And my response to that is, no, this is an example of how well science works, because we take stock of results, but then we always try to clarify and to prove or disprove and to poke holes in if there are holes to be found. Isn't that a healthy thing to you?
Yeah, I think so. It's one of the real powers of science, is that you try not to fool yourself and you recognize that you're the easiest person to be fooled. And that's why you have peer review, and that's why everybody pushes back on your ideas.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's get our first phone call with Brian Koberline of RIT. This is Paul in Rochester. Go ahead, Paul.
Good afternoon, and welcome your guest. Curious question. One, when we think of matter, we think of nothing can travel, quote, faster than the speed of light. Two, supposedly from what they've observed, there's many, many black holes. What if these were to turn out to be gateways to parallel universes, and many of them that could be ran strictly by energy rather than by matter?
Okay. Well,
and yeah, that makes sense.
It does. There's actually an idea that Einstein and others have put forward called a wormhole. And in early general relativity, the idea was, well, could a black hole, in fact, be a wormhole? There's actually been a lot of study on it, and what we find is the answer is no. And the reason the answer is no is because the way gravity works is that if you were to make, you know, a wormhole to another dimension or another place in space, it will tend to pinch off almost immediately. It will pinch off so quickly that you can't even traverse it.
The gravity would kill you.
The gravity would snap everything off. It would become just a black hole.
Would this be gravity towards pulling matter, or can energy, would energy not be affected from the magnetic pull?
Yes, energy is also affected.
So
when we talk about matter in general relativity, we're actually talking about mass and energy. They both can curve space, and they both can affect gravity.
Okay, well, let me go back to my book, and I'll keep reading.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks for the question, Paul. Appreciate that. It's 844-295-TALK. If you have a question or comment, it's 844-295-8255, or right here in Rochester. It's 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Piggybacking off that, Ron just wants to know, how do you define a wormhole, and isn't it the same as a black hole? So he just said, no, it's not a black hole, but let's do definitions again. So a definition of a wormhole, first of all, do we know that they exist?
No, they're purely hypothetical, and every indication is that they don't exist.
Every indication is that they do not.
Right.
Do you suspect they don't?
I suspect they don't.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is it that you suspect they don't because they're not traversable, or that they don't exist at all? They're just an idea.
They're an idea that shows up, but it raises far more problems in the physical models than it solves. And when people actually look at this in detail, what they find is wormholes are not stable. Even if you could create a wormhole somehow, It wouldn't stay a wormhole. It would collapse off into black holes. You wouldn't get these in long-term effects.
There's no way to comprehend the notion of a wormhole that doesn't collapse on itself, that doesn't have the gravity that would kill you if you traversed it.
Based upon the physics that we know.
Okay.
Yes.
Now, the idea, the happy theory about a wormhole is that you could potentially traverse and end up in another galaxy, another part in the same galaxy. What is the idea?
Right. Well, it depends on what theory you want to go with. So you enter the realm of science fiction. You could go to an alternate dimension. You could go to, you know, a galaxy a billion light years away, all sorts of things.
Are there any respectable theories, or are there any really big science minds who do think that this is likely possible?
There are some who think that it might be possible. Where it shows up more is in quantum theory. People trying to look at quantum gravity. One of the things that you would have in the deepest levels of the fabric of space-time would be what's known as quantum foam, all of these kind of fluctuations of space and time. And one of the ideas there is that small wormholes could appear from these quantum fluctuations. They would disappear very quickly. But the idea does show up in some models.
Okay. So hope that clears that up for Ron. Tim in Webster has a comment or question on gravity waves. Go ahead, Tim.
Okay. Hi, guys.
Hi, Dan.
I like the topic of the show here. So here's my question. One of the things when I read about this stuff occasionally is I never really hear gravity talked about in terms of potential energy. And, I mean, that's really kind of one definition of gravity, isn't it?
Yeah, that's one way you can define it, yes.
So, and then I hear things about gravity waves, and one of the things is, like, if all of a sudden if you could magically put a gravity center in somewhere, would it propagate waves? And I think that they've proved that recently. Is that true?
According to relativity, yes. If you had some mass or you disrupted some mass, you would create gravitational waves.
So if you can create gravitational waves, you're also creating waves of potential energy. Is that true?
Well, waves that carry energy, yes. In fact, it's the one indirect evidence we have of gravitational waves, and that is that if you look at what's known as a binary pulsar, these are neutron stars that orbit another star. We've actually observed some of these very precisely, and what we see is that their orbits are decaying, and they're decaying because the gravitational wave energy is taking energy out of the system and carrying it away. So gravitational waves really do carry energy.
But how does that relate to an object's actual potential energy? So, I mean, the Earth sitting out in space just has X potential energy.
Well, you have to be careful about potential energy because it depends upon what's accessible and what's not.
And what's nearby, right?
Right, right.
Okay. Well, fascinating topic. Thank you.
Thank you, Tim.
I hope we
solved Tim's question there. If you want to join the program with comments or questions, black holes or otherwise, Brian Koberlein is here. He is an astrophysicist and a senior lecturer at RIT and the author of a science blog called One Universe at a Time. Our conversation was prompted by Stephen Hawking's recent announcement that he thinks he's got a big question surrounding black holes figured out, the information paradox. And you can call the program if you want to weigh in, you know, if you want to start disproving Hawking, if you've got a better idea. It's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Mark wanted to know, who gets to peer review Stephen Hawking? What's that process like, Brian?
Well, he has to submit it to some journal, and the editor of that journal will determine where it goes to and who it goes to. Typically, in a peer review process, articles are submitted to people who are qualified to assess the merits of the work. So they work in a similar field, but they don't work exactly with these people. So it would be someone who isn't working specifically with Hawking, but who also works on black holes or information theory.
How many people total are going to do the peer reviewing?
It depends. It could be anywhere between 2 and 4 or 5, depending on the journal.
And how often do we see someone like Stephen Hawking or the creator of a paper resist a peer review?
There's often where someone will submit a paper and then it gets criticism and then you push back and then it gets refinements or more criticism. Sometimes it's sent out to an extra reviewer. So if you're just having, you know, a lot of contention between the reviewer and the author, you may say, well, let's get a second opinion, as it were.
Kind of a mediator?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, so you kind of get the outside part of it. So it depends on how controversial the topic is, and it depends on, you know, what the claims are.
It's going to be fascinating to see what happens with Hawking. All right, back to the phones, and Keith in Pittsburgh is next. Go ahead, Keith.
I have an interesting show. Got a question for the professor. Let's say if somebody has a theory and they can prove their theory mathematically, but then you know it can't physically happen because it totally goes against the laws of physics. Does that mean anything? Or let's say if somebody can theoretically prove that black holes exist due to mathematics and something like that, but then again, the laws of physics seem to make it somewhat problematic. Does that become an issue? I'll give you an example.
Yeah.
I was watching that program on XXIL a couple years ago, and one of the questions that came up, let's say you have a sun with planets orbiting around it, as they normally would, and the sun disappeared, what would happen to the planets? Would they continue in the circular motion, or would they just go off in a straight line tangent to the original orbit? And I guess it was proven that they would go off in a straight line tangent to the original orbit. So they were able to prove that. But we know the laws of physics, matter can't be made or you can only change matter. So you can't make the sun disappear. But you are able to prove what would happen if the sun disappeared. So if people were to prove other stuff mathematically that you know the laws of physics wouldn't apply, does that make that mathematical proof irrelevant?
Not entirely, no. One of the things to keep in mind is that theoretical astrophysicists are kind of like cosmic genies. They can make up theoretical universes, and they have a very tiny office space. So what they can do is they can pose what-if questions. Sometimes they're called Gedanken experiments or thought experiments. What if this could happen? What would be the consequences based upon the theory we have? And so something like that of, if the sun were to disappear, I don't know how it would, I don't know that it could, but if I were to make it disappear, what would happen under general relativity as a theory? And we do this all the time. That doesn't mean that we actually think the sun could disappear, but it's a way of testing the ideas within a model. But when it comes down to determining what's right or what's not, it really comes down to the experimental evidence. The experiment gets to be the final arbiter of what our theories are.
But why would, again, to cite your example, why would somebody take and waste the time and effort and energy to try to prove come up with an idea and try to prove it when you know it has no application or it's not going to apply to anything, i.e. the sun disappearing, what's going to happen to the planet?
Oh, because
you know that just can't happen.
Well, thinking outside of the box can always be creative. I mean, a good example would be Einstein. When Einstein was developing his theory of relativity, he proposed ideas of, well, what if I could ride my bicycle near the speed of light? He never could, but he thought, what would happen if? And that led him to develop the theory that could be experimentally determined. So sometimes you come up with crazy ideas and you kind of just play around with them. It's like a game that you play around with, and that can lead to new discoveries.
The other question I had to ask, if you watch The Big Bang Theory, I do, and I really enjoy the program.
Brian?
I have seen it. I'm not really a big fan.
Oh, all right. Well, it's your loss then.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Keith. Thanks for the phone call. Before I jump back on the phones, I do think it's an interesting question. Not just the idea of why do an experiment that seems like it's an eventuality that could never happen, but more, what if part of what you are discovering seems to fly in the face of what you may already accept as sort of the law of physics or mathematics? Now, look, Brian, I'm probably wrong here. I thought it was Newton or somebody else who had something that was long accepted that has since been shown to be erroneous. I don't know if it regards to dark matter or whatever, but I suspect there are many.
There's a long list of theories that were once thought to be true that are now seen as mistaken.
Yeah, and I go back to the process. I would think that is healthy, that if you're working on something and all of a sudden you think, boy, this looks totally pat, like I've got this down, but it would have to indicate that another idea is wrong. Well, that just means you've got more work to do to explore that.
Right. And that's one of the interesting things about how science develops. A lot of times you'll have a theory that covers 99% of what you want to cover, except for this, well, small detail. And most of the time, you know, if you keep pushing at that small little detail, all of a sudden it opens up into a bigger and bigger problem. And this is, you know, the information paradox is a good example of that. It's like, oh, that's an interesting thing, but we'll figure it out. We don't figure it out. And then it becomes a big problem. And then it becomes central to our understanding of physics. So this happens all the time.
Before I get back to the phones then, tell me why this black hole question, is particularly with what Stephen Hawking is working on. Why should we care? What is the possible impact?
We should care because if you see the world as patterns of information, if you see that is being important, and that's what it seems to be, then if information can be destroyed, that means very basic ideas of physics are wrong. Quantum mechanics is somehow wrong. General relativity is somehow wrong. These ideas that we have as kind of the foundation bedrock of reality as we understand it would be wrong if information can be destroyed. So Hawking's trying to save this idea.
That is a big deal.
It is a big deal. And if he can prove that information isn't destroyed, then that will actually kind of solidify some of the ideas we have about the nature of reality.
All right, let's get back to the phones after a short break. If you're just joining us, we're talking about black holes, Stephen Hawking, and the nature of our universe. Just some light discussion points on a Thursday afternoon. My guest is Brian Koberlein, an astrophysicist, senior lecturer at RIT, and the author of a science blog called One Universe at a Time. Short break, more of your phone calls next. I'm Evan Dawson on The Next Connections. It's Arts Friday. David Foster Wallace is the subject of a new biopic. We'll examine his legacy and work and why his work is so hot these days. Then, second hour, we talk about Jiva's upcoming season. There's some changes at the top of Jiva. We'll hit that too and talk about their schedule as well. It's all coming up Arts Friday on Connections.
California's governor wants to double the energy efficiency of buildings and get half the state's electricity from renewables.
This is exciting. It's bold. It's absolutely necessary.
Can it be done?
It is a mandate to accomplish an infeasible goal within an infeasible time.
California's clean energy plan later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on WXXI.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. As one of our listeners on Twitter said, it's like Science Friday came a day early. and we're having a good time with this. Our listeners always have interesting questions. And the next one up is Mark in Rochester. Go ahead, Mark.
Hey, great. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I appreciate it. I actually have two questions if you're able to indulge me, but if not, that's
no,
okay.
Go ahead.
First one, I heard a theory once. I've only heard it once, and I was wondering if you could comment on it, whether you've heard it and whether it's valid or not. The idea that nothing actually does fall into a black hole, that is, as an object approaches a black hole, it's accelerated to such a speed it actually approaches the speed of light. Obviously, it can't exceed that, but it approaches the speed of light. And then, in effect, time slows to the point where it just never really gets there. I'm wondering if that's really a valid idea, or is it perhaps a mistaken perspective? You know, time being relative, is mm-hmm. there a problem with perspective from the object versus a person or an observer of the object?
Okay, you're half right. And that is, there isn't a universal clock. So the experience of time, the flow of time, depends upon your point of view. So if you were to toss something into a black hole and you watched it from the outside, what you would see is that object approach closer and closer to the black hole, and you would see its time slow down and slow down and slow down. You would never actually see it enter the black hole. You'd never see it cross the event horizon from your perspective on the outside. Now, from the object's perspective, it would easily cross the event horizon, it would enter the black hole, and it would be forever trapped. And so you get what looks like it's not crossing the event horizon from the outside, when in fact it actually is.
Okay, excellent. Second, and it's more a suggestion really than a question, could you talk about tidal forces related to black holes? Because I think that's something, if people are listening in and they're not aware of that, they'd be really interested in. And because it, actually my understanding is for most physical objects, the tidal forces are going to tear them apart long before they actually enter the black hole itself.
Right, right. And in fact, we have a term for it called spaghettification. It's, if you think of it this way.
That can't be a real term.
That's a real term. It's a real term we use.
Spaghettification.
Spaghettification.
There is something you learned today that you did not know. Go ahead, Brian.
Yeah, if you think about standing on the Earth, all of the mass is under you. And your feet are actually closer to the mass of the Earth than the top of your head. And so that means that the pull of gravity from the Earth is slightly higher at your feet than it is at the top of your head. Now, for something like the Earth, this is negligible. It's almost no difference at all. But in a black hole, because you have so much mass concentrated into such a tiny volume, when you approach a black hole, your feet, if you were going feet first, could feel a massive amount of more force than the top of your head. And so you would feel this stretching. You'd almost be stretched like spaghetti, hence the term. For something like a star-sized black hole, that becomes a very significant factor. And in fact, you'd be ripped apart, your spaceship would be ripped apart before you reach the black hole. But for really massive black holes, the tidal forces aren't that big near the surface, near the event horizon. And so you could actually, for a supermassive black hole, you may fall into a black hole and not even notice.
Does that answer your questions?
Yeah, that was great. Thank you.
Thanks for
calling. On both questions.
Yeah, Mark, thanks for the call. I appreciate that. It's 844-295-TALK to get in with a question or comment for Brian Koberline. We're talking black holes and more. And back on the phone, Sandy in Mendon is next. Go ahead, Sandy.
Hi. Thanks so much for this conversation. What you're saying about time, I've always had a problem with, because it implies no free will, no real consciousness. And there was an article recently in Discover where a man named Ellis, who's also a cosmologist, was talking about the same thing, and he's trying to show that there's not just the block universe where time can either go forward or backward. Can you say something about that?
Well,
are you familiar with Ellis?
Vaguely. I mean, the questions of free will and determinism actually arise not just in relativity, but even in Newtonian physics and in quantum mechanics. It's a long-standing debate that's been had in physics. The interesting thing is that the idea of relative time doesn't necessarily invalidate free will or determinism in how you frame it. What it means is that your experience of time is independent of other people's experience of time, and that the connections that we make between different events can be perceived in different ways. And so how far apart in time they are, or whether one comes before the other, can depend upon your point of view. But it's not just relativity that raises that question of free will and determinism. It's been there for centuries.
But you really didn't say whether you thought that there was free will or not.
Well, I think it's a complex question, and I think it depends on what you mean by free will. You could have a whole debate just on that.
I see. Okay, thank you so much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Sandy. The question on free will has inspired more debate in the scientific community than I have seen in the last 18 months to 2 years than the previous decade. Sam Harris wrote a book about it. He was challenged by Dan Dennett. There's all kinds of things back and forth. So very interesting. But I think Brian's right. It does a little bit depend on exactly what you mean by free will.
Right.
But that is heavy reading for a different time if you want to jump into that. But Sandy, thank you for the phone call. Bill in Bloomfield, next up. Go ahead, Bill.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. Your guest a little while ago said that the evidence is the final arbiter. And so I'm going to try to put this out there if I can. So relativity theory and quantum theory were proposed in the early 20th century, and both of them were verified within around 10, 15 years. And there's never been an experiment done since that has, you know, indicated that the theories might be false. Everything has confirmed it. Now what we have is string theory and various multiverse theories that have both been around in various forms for, I don't know, 40, 50, 60 years. Neither of them has yet made a prediction that can be tested. No experiments have been done. And as far as we know, the scientific method, as we've come to accept it for however many hundred years, cannot be applied to them. And so the problems that I see are twofold. Number one, as Lee Smolin has suggested, you can't get a job in a major university or a major research center in physics unless you sign on to one of these two prevailing theories, and that is keeping other possible theories from being, you know, getting the kind of support in research that they should give. And the other thing is that in the United States, science is coming under question from the right. And George Will, who is a longtime conservative commentator, said in a piece not too long ago, hands up everyone who believes in string theory. And his point was, if you know, the scientific method can't be applied to string theory, then that puts science into question. And if science is put into question, then all the climate science and all this business that the political right puts into question, gain some traction from that, questioning of what's going on with these theories. They're called science, but the scientific method cannot be applied. So could you comment on that, please?
Sure. String theory suffers from kind of an inconvenient name, and that's because it straddles both physics and mathematics. In physics...
Go ahead.
In physics, when we talk about a theory, we talk about a scientific theory that is verifiable by experiment. In mathematics, when you talk about a theory, you talk about a mathematical structure. So group theory or geometry theory is not a scientific theory in the sense that you're looking at the experimental test, but you're looking at mathematical rigor. So when we talk about string theory could mean a lot of different things. It could mean the mathematical structure that is self-consistent within itself, that is the study of these groups and relationships that could apply to physics, and that's mathematics. And then you have string models that try to use the mathematical structure of string theory towards physical models. And there hasn't been any confirmation of any of these string models being applicable to the physics that we know. However, the mathematical structure of string theory, as it's a mathematical thing, has actually made a lot of advances in our understanding of physics that we understand now.
And Jake online listening was going to weigh in on the last caller. I want to get his comment. He sent a couple of comments. I want to get his comment and question for you, which is this. The concept of a black hole having charge always confused me. How does it gain or lose charge, and what does it generally mean for explaining black hole behavior?
Well, we don't think that black holes particularly have much charge in the real world. But in principle, if you wanted to make a black hole with charge, all you would have to do is throw charges into a black hole. So if you took protons, for example, protons have a positive electric charge. If you just kept tossing protons into a black hole, the black hole would gain charge, and then it would have a positive charge.
Jake, I hope that answers your question. You can write back to the program if that does or does not. I'll get back to the phones, and Bill and Victor is next. Go ahead, Bill.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a couple of short questions. Can you observe black holes developing, and do they ever disappear? And secondly, do black holes play any role in the development of the universe or in maintaining its current form? In other words, what would happen if black holes were to disappear?
Well, that's an interesting question. We have seen black holes, or the indirect evidence of black holes, at different stages in development. So we know quasars, for example, are active black holes in young galaxies. So they are young, still forming black holes. In terms of their role, one of the areas where they do seem to play a role is in the evolution of galaxies. Because you have this central mass in the center of a galaxy, it can affect the dynamics of how a galaxy works. If two galaxies collide, the black holes within those galaxies will interact, and that will affect the evolution of the galaxies. I don't know what it would look like if there weren't black holes there, but they certainly do play a role in the dynamics and evolutions of galaxies over billions of years.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bill. Thanks for the phone call. And let's get to John in Rochester, who's been waiting. Go ahead, John.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question was in regards to like the speed of light and time dilation. So I understand the faster an object moves approaching the speed of light, the time will pass relatively more slowly.
Right.
Does
from
that
our
process
point of view, yes.
work in reverse?
Meaning, does it...
Or is there any kind of... theory that process could work in reverse?
Well, again, time depends upon your perspective. So if you were racing past me at near the speed of light, then I would say, well, you're moving fast and your time appears to be slow. You, however, if you were racing past me, it would look as if I was racing past you. And you would say that I'm moving fast and my time would appear to be slow. And so we would each have our own perspective.
Okay. So I guess my question would be, like, more specifically, so there's no, we don't have any means to experiment to find a way to slow things down relative to the speed of light, do we?
Well, we know when things move very quickly, we do know that their time appears to slow down. So in particle accelerators, for example, we can look at particles that will decay, and we know they decay at a certain rate. They have a certain half-life, as we call it. And when we have them moving very quickly, that half-life gets longer. We know that that works. We've taken atomic clocks, and when we move them very quickly, their time slows down. And in fact, GPS, for example, requires us to take into account relativity and time dilation. GPS wouldn't work if we didn't take into account relativity.
Wow. John, answer your question?
No, it probably just prompted me to ask five more, but I appreciate the information. Thank you for the show. This has been fascinating.
Thanks, okay. John. Well, isn't that the definition of science, Brian Koberlein?
you answer one question and you raise five more.
Yeah, no question about it. We'll get back to the phones in a second. Jake follows up to say, the early universe was more charged. Couldn't primordial black holes be highly charged?
Well, the early universe had a lot of charges, but it was still electrically neutral. So there were protons and electrons, but the overall total charge would still be zero, basically, on average. So it's possible that early black holes could have had a charge, but we're not sure of that.
All right, back to the phones. John and Victor, you're on with Brian Koberlein. Go ahead. Go ahead, John.
Yeah, wanted to know... black holes, is there a limit to how much matter they can consume before they shut down? Is it infinite or finite? And any comments on that regards?
Sure. Well, in a practical sense, I don't know what the actual upper limit would be, but there does come a point where it wouldn't have a strong enough gravity to continue bringing in matter. So there is kind of an upper limit. I don't know what that theoretical, hypothetical limit might be. I know that there are black holes that are billions of solar masses in mass. Billions.
Much bigger than the black hole at the center of our galaxy.
Yeah, our center of the universe, the center of the galaxy black hole is actually relatively small. It's only 4 million solar masses.
And only there
are,
4
there,
million.
There are ones that are billions. I think the highest one is like 12 or 14 billion that we've confirmed.
Just, again, that's just absolutely remarkable. Is there an average size of a black hole, Brian?
It really depends upon the galaxy itself. I mean, a lot of them are in millions or tens of millions. There are some that are much larger. Just like stars, there are small stars and large stars. There are small supermassive black holes and large supermassive black holes.
Stars is just kind of a little guy.
Yeah.
It's a little guy in the center of our galaxy, 4 million suns. But when you talk about the upper limit then, we haven't observed it yet, right?
No, we haven't observed it yet.
We suspect there is a limit.
Well, you could talk about a theoretical limit because the universe is expanding. So basically, as a black hole, we're trying to bring in mass. As the universe expands, less and less matter gets accessible to it. So over time, there would be a maximum limit, you know, in a theoretical sense.
You also mentioned earlier this hour that a galaxy can be impacted structurally, if black holes collide. Have we seen that, and what happens there?
We see evidence of black holes that are spiraling towards each other. So we see in galaxy collisions where we can see two black holes in this colliding galaxy that are actually orbiting each other, and we can see evidence of that. There is some evidence of a large black hole that would seem to be the result of a merged black hole. We haven't actually observed, you know, a merging black hole. We haven't found
one would kind of eat the other?
Yeah, they would eat. They would combine together and become a larger black hole.
Okay. See, all the things that you didn't think that you knew about black holes this hour. So let's start to think about wrapping this up optimistically here. What are the questions that stand out to you? When Stephen Hawking is out with his paper, which is going to be in the next few weeks?
Yeah, yeah.
What are the first questions you want answered?
Well, the biggest one I want to see is how he deals with some of the problems that other people have encountered. So lots of people have looked on this, and there are other paradoxes that rise up, like the firewall paradox and other things. I want to see how he thinks he's overcome those problems.
Okay. And again, if you're tuning in a little late, Stephen Hawking claims to have solved the information paradox, right?
Right.
How many different sort of components or questions about black holes are outstanding still, Brian?
Oh, well, there's a lot of them. I mean, there's the information paradox.
You mentioned firewall. I don't know what that is.
The firewall paradox is that if you suppose you could allow quantum fluctuations to carry information, if you do that, that means particles would spring into being kind of right at the event horizon, and anything trying to go into the black hole would be vaporized. It would create like a firewall where nothing could go into a black hole. Well, that would be a problem because that means the black holes couldn't form. You know, other problems are in general relativity, anything that goes into a black hole would collapse into a singularity, meaning that all of that matter and energy would collapse down to an absolute single physical point. All the physics would break down at that point. Well, what happens? Do singularities actually form, or is it some other mechanism that prevents them from forming? We don't know.
What's the size of a singularity?
It would be zero.
It would be zero.
It would be, yeah.
It'd have to be non-zero, wouldn't it?
No. A singularity mathematically would be of zero volume, that all the mass of the star or the 4 million suns would be in a point of zero volume.
Wow. Okay. So these are things that stand out. So Hawking is attacking the information paradox.
Right.
And Brian admitted during our short break that there's a lot riding on this, because if Hawking is right, it helps uphold a lot quantum mechanics and a lot of ideas that are out there. It doesn't collapse those things. So there's a lot riding on it. But you said there's a small part of you that's just for the fun of it, hoping it's wrong?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things that whenever we find a big problem, it could open up in a whole new world. Quantum mechanics is a good example. The early 1900s, we thought we pretty much had it. It opened up the entire field of quantum theory, a whole new universe, because we couldn't solve these little problems.
I guess we'll have to come back in a different hour and talk about quantum mechanics.
Sure.
Is it among the most debated? Where does it rank in sort of scientific back and forth, push and pull?
For quantum theory?
Yeah.
It is probably the most robustly tested theory we have.
Okay. So let's hope Hawking has some success here. I'm hoping that he's right. And then briefly explain then, why did the scientific community react sort of like meh with what he came out with in Stockholm?
Because he claimed he had the solution and he didn't show us the solution.
He gave you like the trailer of the movie?
Right, right. So we want to see the movie.
And he gave you the trailer. he gave you the trailer. Well, it's Stephen Hawking. I would think by now in his career he's not over-promising.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's an interesting thing. Anything he says gets hyped, you know, because he's Stephen Hawking.
But in this case, it doesn't seem like media overhype. He's the one saying.
Right.
He's got this.
Right.
This is not
right.
The media saying, oh, we're overselling what Stephen Hawking might have.
Right. He's promised a lot, so he has a lot he has to offer.
No, it has been a remarkable hour. And so we got about a minute left here. What else is on your big scientific plate? You write One Universe at a Time. That's Brian's blog, where he really does break these things down very helpfully, almost day by day. Are you posting every day?
Pretty much.
Every weekday?
Yeah, every day.
Every
7 days a week.
Day.
Yes.
So what's on your plate right now? What else is interesting that's
Well, the biggest thing that I want to read up on is possible evidence of a neutrino background in the universe, which is kind of like the last big test of the Big Bang.
Is a neutrino a real thing?
Yes, it is.
That is? Okay.
That is, absolutely.
Okay. Because this is going to sound really ridiculous, but in seventh grade, the smartest student I knew growing up, Eric Jameson Deeds, who now teaches in Kansas, said neutrinos were going to be the key to time travel. In seventh grade.
Well, if he can submit his paper to peer review, we can check it out.
I suspect he's long since moved on. Okay. What else is out there for you?
You know, it's just there's so many things happening right now. I mean, it really is an exciting time. We're getting the Gaia of satellite is going to start measuring large collections of stars. We're going to measure a billion stars in our local galaxy, not only know where they are, but how they're moving. And that's more than we've ever had. We've only measured a small fraction of our galaxy. We're going to understand this now. We're going to understand the dynamics of stars. We've really come a long way, and we've got a lot to go still.
Thanks for coming in and having some fun with our listeners. Our listeners really enjoy having someone of your caliber who can explain and kind of have this dialogue. And so let's do it again soon. I always
Sure.
enjoy it. Thank you, Brian.
Thank you.
Brian Koberline is an RIT senior lecturer. He's an astrophysicist, and his blog, One Universe at a Time, has this kind of stuff every day in really, really sort of short, digestible terms. Great stuff. Thanks for all the great phone calls these 2 hours today, and have a great afternoon. We'll talk to you on Arts Friday on Connections.